This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, you recall, we took a look at the electronic gadgets coming out of the Consumer Electronics Show. And one of this year's big buzzy things was that talk about the 4G network. Sprint, AT&T, Mobile, Verizon all have 4G now. But what exactly does 4G mean? Because if you peel off that 4G label, they work differently, and in some cases, those technologies aren't even running at the same speeds. But the networks are still advertised as 4G. So what's the difference? And why are even the fastest networks in the U.S. so much slower than networks in places like Sweden and Australia? If the technology is there, why isn't it here? Well, what do you think? Do you have a 4G network already? Let us know. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can tweet us at SciFry, that's at SCIFRI, or go to our website at Science Friday and get in on a conversation there. Chris Ziegler is the senior mobile editor at Engadget in Chicago. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira, how are you?
A lot of folks, a lot of 4G at that electronic show, was it not?
Yes. Every American carrier was talking 4G there.
And is there a common definition for what 4G means?
You know, it's interesting. There actually is. There is a technical definition that's controlled by the ITU, which is a body that's run by the UN. And people might be amazed to discover that no current network advertising itself as 4G actually meets those requirements.
No kidding. No.
It's true.
The UN controls the requirements and no one meets it. So what does it mean when they're saying 4G? What are they actually talking about?
Well, what they're referring to, the biggest and most consumer noticeable part of that definition is the fact that they're looking for speeds of 1 gigabit per second down to your device when you're stationary and 100 megabits per second when you're mobile, because it is actually harder to transfer data when you're moving than when you're standing still. So that's what they're looking for. And the only proposed standards that meet that definition are WiMAX 2 and LTE Advanced, and neither of those standards even exist yet in a commercial network.
Well, isn't AT&T supposed to deploy LTE later this year?
They are, but there's a big difference between LTE and LTE Advanced, unfortunately. But yeah, so what AT&T is doing, they have the most confused message of all the American carriers, I believe, because basically what they've done is they've responded to T-Mobile. T-Mobile recently launched what's called HSPA Plus, which is an evolution, a very advanced evolution of 3G that we've had for a few years now, that can go up to 21 megabits and beyond, which easily rivals what you can get in your home with like a broadband connection. So what AT&T did is they said, well, hey, we have HSPA Plus 2. We can't let T-Mobile get away with calling their network 4G, and we're not. So we're going to rebrand that network as 4G, but we're also launching LTE later this year. So we're going to bundle that all into one package.
Is this purposely made to confuse us, all this different technology?
Well, you know, believe it or not, all the executives and marketing folks that I've talked to with these companies insist that they do it to simplify things for consumers, not to complicate things. They don't want to talk about HSPA Plus or LTE because they, you know, they very rightfully say that people don't care, and they don't. That's true. People absolutely don't care. They just want fast data. They don't care how they get it. So they're trying to use these G labels as, an equivalency rating. They just want people to know, hey, this is, you know, this is as fast as Verizon's network, so we're going to call it 4G, just like Verizon.
Mm-hmm. So the basic thing to know is that whatever the new thing is, 4G, whatever technology it is, it will be faster than 3G, better?
That's right. Yes, that's right.
So that's the takeaway message, that if you go in and get a cell phone, that's what you're asking for.
That's right. If you get a 4G device, you will absolutely get a faster data experience. You'll load websites faster. You'll be able to use services like Pandora faster. You'll do all of that. You'll have a cleaner and faster experience with a 4G device regardless of the carrier. And right now, today, all of the carriers will give you roughly the same experience with a 4G network. Over time, that'll evolve, mm-hmm. and you'll see some of these newer technologies like LTE evolve faster and better, and those will get much, much faster. I'm sure that the marketing groups will say, well, you know, maybe you want to call that 4.5G, maybe you want to call that 5G. We'll see what they do. But for now, 4G is 4G is 4G.
Let's talk about another bit of technology babble that came out, something called WiMAX. What is WiMAX? How does that work?
Yeah, so WiMAX is the quote-unquote 4G technology that's in use by Sprint, and they have a few devices available right now that make use of WiMAX. They have the HTC Evo 4G, which they've been advertising very heavily. I'm sure a lot of folks are aware of. But they also have the Epic 4G from Samsung and a couple others. And it's one of the older next-generation data technologies, but it's very robust. The one disadvantage that Sprint has is that they use a very high frequency for transmitting that data. And there's a concept of physics by which the higher you go with frequency, the harder it is for this RF to penetrate buildings.
Right.
So they're operating at 2,500 megahertz, and it's very, very difficult for that signal to penetrate deep inside buildings, whereas Verizon and AT&T for their 4G networks are both using 700 megahertz, which is much lower, and it's easier to get deep inside buildings.
Do you have your favorite recommendations for a 4G network or how you would like to see it work?
Well, you know, what I tell people is that they do need to experiment with all networks. You know, just go into a store and experiment with devices and see which is faster in their market, because it does vary a lot by market. What's fastest in New York might be the slowest in San Francisco and might be, you know, middle of the road in Chicago. You just don't know. Mm-hmm. And it also varies a lot in rural areas too.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I mentioned earlier in the billboard here, other countries have wireless networks that are much faster than ours.
Yes.
Why is ours so much slower?
Well, there are a couple reasons for that. One is that the U.S. has really, really led the push into high bandwidth, high experience smartphones. Even though countries like Japan and a lot of countries across Europe have been pushing the benefits of smartphones for longer than the U.S. has, devices like the iPhone have really grown up and taken root first in the U.S., and that has pushed wireless broadband adoption faster than pretty much anything else. So we consume a lot and a lot of data here. And what carriers are struggling with is coming up with enough backhaul, and that's the connection between the cell tower and the internet backbone. They're struggling to come up with enough bandwidth there for these devices, and they're also struggling to come up with enough spectrum to connect the cell tower to the phone. So these are the kinds of bottlenecks that we're dealing with here that they're not dealing with as much yet in other countries.
Is it a good thing that we're seeing all these new cell phones coming out? And, you know, the iPhone was ruling for a while, and now we have Android has taken over in sheer numbers of phones, and now you have iPhone available on Verizon as well as AT&T. This is all good in competition?
It's absolutely good for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's always great when you have a single device that's available across multiple carriers, because that means that you don't have to say, well, you know, I want an iPhone, so that means I have to use AT&T. I have to break my contract with X carrier and go to AT&T. A variety of carriers is always a good thing. But then also, this rapid adoption of high bandwidth smartphones has really pushed the FCC and the trade organization that rounds up all the carriers to push for to get a lot of additional spectrum freed up that we can use for these phones in the future. So the FCC has pushed very hard to free up about a half gigahertz of spectrum, which is a lot of spectrum over the next decade or so, and that's going to help a lot with the bottlenecks we're facing.
It appears that the phone is morphing into more of a digital device rather than a voice device.
Absolutely, yep.
You know.
That's absolutely true. Over the past couple years, we've seen the rapid adoption of full QWERTY keyboards, for example, on phones. And I think that speaks to the fact that people are texting as much or more than they're talking now. And that certainly didn't used to be the case. And of course, these large touch screens make it really easy to use apps and browse the web. And these are all things that, you know, instead of talking to your friends on the phone like you might have 10 years ago, now you just send them a post in Facebook, for example.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we're going to come up with some standard rating for all these various wireless technologies that will really be able to measure each one?
Unfortunately, I don't. I haven't seen any government or trade organizations step up to say, hey, we need to really lock this down. I think that it's going to be up to marketing organizations within all these companies to come up with logical, sensical standards. I don't know if we can trust them to do that, but I have to admit, even though the 4G definition that they're using right now isn't technically accurate, it does do a pretty decent job of showing equivalency across all four of these major U.S. networks.
And what slows down? You talked about different reception in different cities. Is it the physical structures in the city, or is it the density of cell phones? Because I know when I go to a baseball game, when the beginning of the game is no one in the stadium, I have no trouble with my phone. As it fills up, it's gone.
Yeah. No, I'll give you a perfect example, a famous example. For the past, I think it's 3 years at CES, you have this crush of technology reporters all filtering into Vegas at the same time.
Right.
And by, the middle of day one of the show, your iPhones don't work because, everyone has an iPhone and the AT&T network is just crushed. And to be fair, they do try to do a good job. They have these trucks called cows that are basically portable cell towers that they bring in and station around the grounds to try and alleviate the congestion, but they can only do so much. So you end up having a lot of trouble there. So population density is a factor. And then also, like you mentioned, physical structures. That's a problem,
yeah,
too. In big cities, that's a huge problem.
Are the phone companies spending money on building the 4G network now?
They are. Yes, they're spending billions. And actually, to a point you made earlier, that's another reason why these networks tend to evolve a little slower in the States than they do elsewhere, because you're talking about a $10 billion plus investment per carrier just to roll out these networks because of the size of the country and the amount of data that they need to support here. It's just immense.
Do you recommend early adapting or just wait a month, 6 months, things will settle out a little bit more? And choices might be more clear.
Yeah, I think that 2011 is going to be a real watershed year for these networks. And I think that by the end of this year, we're going to see a lot of really cool things shake out. I'll give you an example. Verizon, as of right now, even though they do technically have 4G LTE launched, they only have the only devices they have for it are two modems that plug into your laptop, and neither one of them works with a Mac. So it's very limited appeal right now, very limited functionality. The devices are big compared to a 3G modem, and those will miniaturize over time. And, of course, we'll see a number of phones start to support it over the course of the year.
All right, Chris Ziegler, thanks for your help.
Thank you.
And Chris Ziegler is senior mobile editor at Engadget in Chicago, telling us how to survive. It's always 6 months. Wait another 6 months for another gadget. We're going to take a break and come back and test your carbon IQ and a new program to map carbon dioxide and methane emissions right back to their sources. We can trace them and find out why after this break, so stay with us.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. This week, a new book seems to have taken America by storm. It's as if you could hear people gasping in every corner of the country. Did she really write that? Did she really say that? Ouch! I'm talking about the book Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. An excerpt appeared last weekend in the Wall Street Journal under the headline, Why Chinese Mothers Are Superior. Well, all week I've been talking about this book with friends, family, coworkers, and now I have a chance to talk with the Chinese mother who wrote it. Amy Chua joins us now from New Haven. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Michelle.
Can you, in a few words, tell us what you were hoping to communicate with this book? What's the core message?
Well, I was raised myself by extremely strict but also extremely loving Chinese immigrant parents. To this day, I believe that they're having high expectations for me, coupled with love, was the greatest gift that anyone's ever given me. And so that's why, even though my husband is not Chinese, I tried to raise my own two daughters the same way. And so the book is about many of the strengths that I see in that kind of tough immigrant parenting, but also about my mistakes. It's about making fun of myself. A lot of people miss this. And ultimately about my decision to sort of pull back when really confronted in a moment of crisis. So the book is absolutely not a how-to book. I do not think the Chinese way is superior. It's a memoir. It's really a sort of a story of my own journey and transformation as a mother. And it does explore these issues. What's the right balance?
It's a journey that you're on, and you really do need to read the entire book and not just the excerpt, because you do land in a very different place at the end of the book. But in the beginning of the book, you spell out some of the things that a Chinese mother believes. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to tick through a few of them, because I do have the book right here with me. Schoolwork always comes first. An A minus is a bad grade. Your children must be 2 years ahead of their classmates in math. You must never compliment your children in public. If your child ever disagrees with a teacher or coach, you must always take the side of the teacher or coach. The only activities your children should be permitted to do are those in which they can eventually win a medal, and that medal must be gold. were these the touch points for your life when you were growing up?
You know, I hope people see, Michelle, that that is a little tongue-in-cheek. I mean, come on. The one thing I can say is I know that my kids grew up knowing that they were deeply, deeply loved. And it was hard. It was hard. And I'm actually really proud of the relationship that we have.
I so appreciated your honesty in this book, because parenting is something that, you know, despite all the manuals and all the discussions about it in public forums, is something that happens behind closed doors. And you are incredibly candid. You really lay bare, you know, what these experiences were like for you. And you write about how you handled your daughter, Lulu, when she was three. What happened on that day?
This was amazing. I thought, oh, great. You know, it's just Lulu and me together. She's about three. I can teach her to play the piano. And I sat her down on these comfortable pillows. And I said, look, Lulu, just play one note three times evenly. And Lulu and I are so similar in personality. She's a fireball. She decided that instead she would smash at the piano with both open palms. And so we had a little back and forth that she just wouldn't do it. And then she was kicking and screaming and thrashing. And finally I said, you know what? I am determined to raise an obedient Chinese in quotes child. I took her, you know, to the front door, and I said, it was a very cold day. And I said, now, if you don't stop screaming and if you don't behave, I am going to put you outside in the cold. She looked at me, and she's 3 years old, and she steps outside into the cold. And I start to panic, you know? The whole book is full of Lulu calling my bluff. I didn't think she would go out there. So I quickly said, okay, you're quiet now. Come back in here. And she just shook her head, and she wouldn't come in. I had to bribe her back in with hot chocolate and brownies. But that's how I set up the book.
Now, you say that you were raised by Chinese immigrants. You married a man who came from a quite different background. Your husband, Jed Rubenfeld, is actually with you now in the studio. You two cut this deal in your marriage that the kids would be raised Jewish. Jed, that's your faith. And as parents, you would adopt this Chinese style of parenting. Jed, did you know what you were getting into when you struck this arrangement?
You know, to me, maybe I'm wrong, but I always thought the way we were raising our kids was more of a traditional American way. You know, the values of hard work and perseverance and being taught that you can overcome obstacles and respect. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. When did Western parenting become associated with the more permissive style? I think it's pretty recent. I mean, I think maybe the 1960s. So I didn't really think of it as Western versus Chinese. I guess I thought of it as maybe a kind of old-fashioned parenting style. It's not the parenting style in which I was raised. My family really did have the more permissive emphasis on individuality, creativity, freedom. And those are great values. And we tried to give our kids those values too. But it's really true that my parents and a lot of parents, I think, in that generation didn't, you know, put expectations on kids. And I'm one of those people who sort of wishes that their parents had made them learn an instrument or something like that.
Did you ever clash over this at all? Were there ever any concerns? And Jed, when I ask you this question, I'm thinking about a moment in the book where you notice these marks on the piano and you realize that your very driven daughter was actually gnawing on the piano when her parents weren't looking.
Well, you know, we did clash a little bit, but never in front of the kids. It was very important to me and to Amy that we presented a united front to the children. And so sometimes I would say to Amy privately that I thought this or that, you know, could be reconsidered. But those marks, whatever they indicated, and I assuming they indicated frustration and, you know, something was hard to do. And things are hard to do for children. And kids will typically give up if the parents don't push them. What kid wants to practice a musical instrument so much that they really get good at it? You know, if a parent doesn't make them, it's probably not going to happen.
Amy, you write that the measure of Chinese parenting is how the children in the end wind up viewing their own mother and father. And you use your own father as a cautionary tale in that sense. He was very resentful of his own parents. And in fact, he was estranged from them because of their outsized expectations. This is a tough question to ask, but I'm wondering what your daughters think of you.
I, knock on wood, Michelle, my girls my girls confide in me. We're good friends. I wasn't such good friends with my parents when I was little. I was terrified of them, so that's a real difference. I mean, I guess I'm proud of the parent that I've been. I know I'm being judged very harshly by people out there. You know, that does hurt. But in the end, it's just how my daughters feel and think about me that matters. They are outgoing, strong-willed girls with lots of friends. And, you know, I think my odds are good, but I don't know. It's a work in progress. I can only hope, you know. We can only try to do our best.
Amy and Jed, thank you so much for being with us. This has been wonderful.
Thanks so much for having us, Michelle.
That's Amy Chua and her husband, Jed Rubenfeld. Amy's new book is Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Two big commercial movies open this week. The Green Hornet is screenwriter and star Seth Rogen's update of the old pulp radio and TV show about a masked hero and his kung fu sidekick. The Dilemma is a comedy starring Vince Vaughn as a man who discovers a secret about the wife of his best friend, played by Kevin James. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of both films.
The Green Hornet and The Dilemma are big-budget male buddy pictures. The first is a semi-satirical action movie. The second, a comedy that turns serious. Both are well-made, and both are tiresome. Folks, the bromance motif, in which grown men wrestle with their masculinity while acting like juveniles, has been wrung dry. The Green Hornet, at least, is likable and a refreshing change from all those heavy, angst-ridden superhero movies. The director is Michel Gondry of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, a virtuoso at making childish fantasies take wing. And I'm not the first to notice a Bob Hope, Bing Crosby road movie vibe between the two stars, Seth Rogen as Britt Reed, a.k.a. the Green Hornet, and Jay Chou as the Kung Fu Master Kato, both smitten with Cameron Diaz in the Dorothy L'Amour role. Rogan's Brit is a ne'er-do-well rich kid, son of a disapproving media mogul played by Tom Wilkinson, who dies suddenly. It's all quite Oedipal. In a prologue, the father tears the head off his son's superhero doll, and the Green Hornet persona is born when Brit and Kato, who was his dad's assistant, knock the head off a statue of Brit's father. Their superhero gimmick is that they'll pretend to be bad guys, but really fight criminals. And Britt wants them to be best buds.
We'll need a car.
Hells yes, we'll need a car.
With strong weapons.
Mm.
And armor.
Cool ribs. Spinning rims.
I can do that.
Kato, I want you to take my hand. I want you to come with me on this adventure.
I'll go with you, but I don't want to touch you.
Okay, you don't have to take my hand, but will you come with me on this adventure?
The Hope Crosby thing might work better if the quips were fresh and Cho was comfortable with English. He speaks as if he learned it phonetically. And unlike Bruce Lee's Kato in the old TV show, he talks a lot, both for PC reasons and because Cho is a big star in the all-important Asian market. Kato refuses to be Brit's sidekick, so he and Rogan trade lame insults while fighting off the bad guys. There are a few neat trick shots in which Kato moves at different speeds than his slow-mo adversaries, and a couple of good 3D effects, like the split screens in which each frame is at a different spatial level. But it's not worth the 3D glasses surcharge. There's little in The Green Hornet that jumps out at you. But it's The Dilemma that really lays there, paralyzed by its seriousness. It's about two unemployed best friends, veterans of the auto industry. Vince Vaughn's Ronnie is a can-do manager, while Kevin James's Nick is the brilliant engineer. Vaughn cooks up a scheme to land a meeting with a big car company, and after it works, they meet up at a crowded bar with Jennifer Connelly as Vaughn's girlfriend, Beth, and Winona Ryder as James's wife, Geneva.
You lying bastard!
You are unbelievable!
Did we get the meeting or not?
I'm hugging this man like I'm some kind of ass.
Why were you hugging the man?
Because he's our guy's direct competitor.
Why would you hug the direct competitor?
Because he had a near-death experience.
Actually, no, he didn't. That never happened. I made that up.
Oh, shame, shame, shame.
What are you doing?
What do you mean, what am I doing? Did we get the meeting or what?
Come on, Nick.
I'm never hugging again. I'm not listening to you, and he sets me up.
What do you expect me to do? Geneva, listen to me. You know him. He's way too honest. If I completely necessary, Nick,
My man. We got the meeting.
I'm not gonna lie. Sometimes I love your boyfriend.
You, I will
get right
this
back.
Is free.
Come in here.
This is not, no
man.
Charge.
Oh, don't ever let me go.
These fleshy guys, one tall, one short and round, have a quintessential manly male project. In a scene that drew considerable advance criticism, Vaughn's Ronnie says of electric cars, they're totally gay, and proposes a new variation, a responsible, energy-efficient car that makes loud vroom-vroom noise like the old Fords and Dodges, like we need more road noise in this world. But the dilemma turns on the women. Ronnie spies Geneva smooching another guy, played by Channing Tatum with a lot of tattoos, and is torn. Should he tell his buddy and shatter him and maybe ruin the project on which everything in their lives rides? Or should he keep it a secret for now? His contortions, moral and physical, occupy the next 90 minutes. Maybe the late Blake Edwards could have found a balance between slapstick and psychodrama, but director Ron Howard can't get the pacing right. Vaughn has a couple of very funny scenes, and Winona Ryder a good demonic glint, but the movie drags, and the central problem, the invention of that noisy engine, ends up a non-issue. The dilemma comes down to whether Ronnie can help Nick recover his masculine pride, symbolized by a scene in a pro hockey arena in which Nick competes to slap a puck into a slot. Even Freud would roll his eyes and tell the filmmakers to grow up.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
And also in West Virginia, reaction continues to filter in. That's after a decision yesterday by the Environmental Protection Agency to revoke a permit for what would have been the largest mountaintop removal mine in the state. West Virginia's political leaders are condemning the agency's veto, saying this will have a chilling effect on the state's coal industry. Emily Carrillo of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports.
Mountaintop removal is a controversial mining method. To get at the coal underground, the tops of mountains are blown off and the rock and dirt are dumped into valleys and streams. The EPA revoked a permit that would have allowed Arch Coal Company to bury tons of rubble in streams. West Virginia's Environmental Protection Secretary, Randy Huffman, says the Army Corps of Engineers issued the permit in 2007, and he disagrees with EPA's veto.
The issue about the veto is the fact that the federal government has gone back on its word and changed its mind after 4 years, and that's just unacceptable.
Huffman says it's unacceptable because it creates an uncertain business climate in a state that relies heavily on coal. Arch Coal was expected to employ 250 people and invest hundreds of millions of dollars. The Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition is one of several groups trying to stop the mine since it was first proposed in the 1990s. Project coordinator Vivian Stockman is pleased with the EPA's veto and not surprised by the reactions of politicians and the coal industry.
They're really failing to look at the big picture here, which is there can be no economic development in areas where there is no clean water.
This EPA decision is part of an Obama administration effort to minimize the environmental impact of mountaintop removal mining. The EPA continues to review dozens of mine permits across Appalachia, saying in a statement, people shouldn't have to make the false choice between healthy waters and a healthy economy. They can have both. For NPR News, I'm Emily Corio in Morgantown, West Virginia.
This is NPR News.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Boy meets girl, they fall in love, they get married, they have children. Nothing new here, but this couple, well, this couple makes one of the most important discoveries of the 20th century. Simple plot, big results. It takes a special couple to be able to work together, but that's exactly what two of history's most famous scientists did. Of course, I'm talking about Marie and Pierre Curie, a couple that worked so closely together that their handwriting overlaps in their notebooks. The story of their relationship and their momentous discovery of radium is getting a fresh look in a new visual biography of the pair. The book is called Radioactive: Marie and Pierre Curie, A Tale of Love and Fallout. It's a beautifully illustrated book. It's done very uniquely, and it jumps forward in time from the Curie's era at the turn of the 20th century to the uses and misuses of radioactivity today. The book investigates the Curie's complicated legacy, from X-rays to cancer treatments to nuclear disasters. And yes, it covers Marie's love affairs, too. We'll talk about that. If you'd like to talk about that with the author or anything else about the Curies, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Lauren Redness is the author. She's an artist and a writer, and she's a professor of fine arts at the Parsons School of Design, author of Radioactive: Marie and Pierre Curie, A Tale of Love and Fallout. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
This is a unique book. The way it's written and the layout, it's, you know, you're drawn to the images more than you're drawn to the text in it.
Well, I wanted the different elements to work together to tell the story, so that the structure of the book, the images themselves, and the written narrative all play a specific role that the others can't play, and together they tell the story.
And, you talk about the notebooks being famous, it's almost like this is a notebook. The style that it's written is almost like a laboratory notebook. Did you intend it to be that way, or did it just turn out like that?
That's really interesting. Well, in a sense, I mean, I did develop a font for this book based on manuscripts in the New York Public Library's collection. I wanted it to have the tone of a certain seriousness and stateliness, and yet to have the certain imperfection and tenderness of a handmade object.
It's beautiful. How as an artist, did you get interested in a science story like this?
Well, their story, I think, opens up the opportunity, as you mentioned, for us to look at our world today in an unexpected way. And in addition, it's also in and of itself a great dramatic story. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the two of the principal themes in the book, love and radiation, are invisible things, was intriguing to me as a visual artist. How do you make a visual book about invisible things?
Mm-hmm. And part of the history of radium and the Curies is that they had no idea about what they were playing with, basically, the dangers involved in playing with all this radiation, did they?
Well, it's really interesting. In some ways, they did. They didn't imagine maybe some of the more specific things, but Pierre Curie asked, is it right to probe so deeply into nature's secrets? Mm-hmm. The question must be asked whether it would be harmful for mankind or whether it will be beneficial. So I think they were grappling with the results of a scientific advance.
Yes, they were not, as you show in the book, they were not afraid to put pieces of radium all over their bodies. They tried to cure, thought about curing cancer early on with it, and they had helmets or things where they pasted all over their heads and stuff.
Right, exactly. They recognized that radium could destroy diseased tissue. As you say, Pierre, at one moment, he takes a little vial of radium, he puts it on his arm, and it creates this lesion that takes a long time to heal. And so they saw, if radium can destroy can destroy healthy tissue, it could also be used to destroy diseased tissue. And so they saw that it had this power, this kind of dual mm-hmm. potential.
And when you went through their notes and their books and things, what did you discover about them? Were they radioactive themselves?
Some of them are, yes.
They still are.
Yeah, and they require researchers to sign a disclaimer. And in the Curie Institute in Paris, you can hold up a Geiger counter and listen to the click, click, click of the notebooks.
And what did you discover about Marie Curie that you didn't know that many of us did not know about her? Because if you ask the general public to name one scientist, she's the only one that comes up.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Is there anything yet to be discovered that you might have about her personal life and anything else that we don't know anything about?
Well, in the course of the book, I think there are two thoughts that come to mind, and I'll get to one in a second. But I start the book with an apology to Marie Curie, because at one time, as you mentioned, she has this scandalous love affair, and she asserts that there is no connection between the goings-on in private life and the facts of the scientific work. And so I try to look at that in her life, how her passion and her curiosity and her role as an intellectual adventurer was a part of both her romantic life but also her scientific work, at the same time that, of course, you know, as it's just empirically true that radioactivity is an atomic property, whether or not she had this love affair with a married man.
Yeah, that shouldn't get in the way of her work.
Right.
Did that news come out? Was it? I mean, she's the first person to ever win two Nobel Prizes.
Right. She was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize, and then, as you say, the first person to win two. And the news of her affair, the affair we're referring to, is when she fell in love after Pierre Curie dies with the physicist Paul Langevin. And Paul Langevin was married. And that news comes to light just at the moment that Marie is awarded the second Nobel Prize in 1911. And in fact, the Nobel Committee did try to prevent her from coming to Stockholm to accept the prize.
Oh, because the letters were published and that created a scandal at the time?
Exactly.
Imagine what would happen today if this happened today.
Right.
The kind of scandal would be much more public, right?
Right.
I would imagine.
Well, yeah, we all have. I mean, would Marie Curie be on Facebook? I don't know.
What do you think they'd say about all this stuff? I mean, how public was their life?
They were very, very private. Marie Curie, I think, was horrified at all of the attention that was lavished upon them when they grew famous, and she even compared herself to the boxer, I think it's Jack Dempsey, and she says, you know, it's as if I'm already dead. She says, this is a horrible fate to have all of these mm-hmm. private details exposed.
Yeah, and did the Curies have any control over their discovery, their radium discovery, after they made that discovery?
Well, they chose not to patent it. They thought that this was knowledge that, you know, one or two individual scientists could not possess.
Mm-hmm. And so then people took radium and marketed it as snake oil and panaceas and things like that, right?
Right. It was such a magical-seeming elixir. People thought that it could cure all kinds of things. And, of course, we've seen that it does have curative or therapeutic possibilities, but it also has very toxic potential as well.
Yeah, it took a while for people to discover that. And, you know, I'm thinking of the radium dials that they used to paint with and things like that.
Yeah.
On watches. You say in your book that their discoveries, quote, blurred the boundary between science and magic.
Mm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they made this discovery at a time when technologies such as electricity and radio and telegraph, the X-ray, were all new. And, for instance, if you look at the X-ray and the fact that this invisible light can pass through human flesh and expose the human skeleton, already that seems quite fantastical. And these new technologies, I think, did for some blur the line between science and magic. And the Curies took this as, you know, they opened themselves to considering something like spiritualism.
Mysticism.
Right. And they attended seances along with many great intellectuals of the period.
That was a lot of people were doing that, not only here but abroad.
Absolutely.
And all over, you know, France, Great Britain, all over the place they were going to seances.
Right. And spiritualists took on a scientific vocabulary in order to put some gravitas to
You had Harry Houdini saying he was coming back after he died. You know, there was that whole era was very heavily mystical.
Yep.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, it was Alexander Graham Bell, Edward Monk.
Exactly.
Lots and lots of people. Mm-hmm. The Curies were not the only Nobel Prize winners to attend seances.
Yeah. The book is more than just the Curie story. You traveled all over the world for this. Where did you visit?
I went to Hiroshima, and I talked to atomic bomb survivors. I went to the Nevada test site outside of Las Vegas, where the the U.S. government tested nuclear bombs during the Cold War. I talked to scientists who worked at Chernobyl and, someone who manufactures fallout shelters and all kinds of things.
After Pierre's death, Marie went on to accomplish a lot more, didn't she? What was some of the other work that she was accomplishing?
Well, one really interesting thing she did was that she stepped outside the laboratory and applied her research to medical use. And during World War I, she had the idea to rig up an automobile with X-ray equipment and create mobile X-ray units. And this was a big advance in treating wounded soldiers.
Mm-hmm. And how did she end her life?
She died of radiation poisoning. I mean, she died of aplastic anemia, which is almost definitely due to her radiation exposure.
Mm-hmm. How did you create the images? They're beautiful, a very unusual look for the book. How did you make these unusual images in the book?
Most of the images in the book are created with a method called cyanotype printing. And this is a cameraless photographic technique, which means, in my case, there are different ways to make a cyanotype. But what I do is I take paper, I coat it with a light-sensitive chemical solution, and then I expose it to light. And the UV rays of the light interact with the chemicals on the paper, and that turns the paper a deeply saturated blue.
Well, it's a beautifully done book.
Oh, thank you.
Very unusual. We get a lot of books in here, and this is really done very nicely. Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
And you can see the book on, if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com, and you go to the SciArts section, you go to the front page there. But you go to sciencefriday.com/arts, go to that website, and you can see portions of the book as well as our art site. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
Lauren Redness is an artist and writer, and she is author of and illustrator of the new book, Radioactive, Marie and Pierre Curie, A Tale of Love and Fallout. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the magnetic pole is moving. How to catch it. Catch it if you can. So we'll be right back. Catch us. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us.